from the Media Broadcasting Center.
Sir, your host on The Real Deal, where I'm very pleased to have as my special guest for the first hour, Peter Morin from the Netherlands, where Peter was the initiator of the covert harassment conference in 2014 and is an organizer of the new covert harassment conference 2015 that will be taking place in Berlin on the 1st and the 2nd of October. Peter, it appears to me this international conference is of enormous significance. Tell us about it.
Yes, Jim. Thank you for inviting me to your show. This conference is really very important. Well, some people say that it is about targeted individuals, but it's also about a problem that affects whole humanity. The world has become a very technical world, and the governments are controlling us much more every day. And so it's very important that everybody knows and understands what the governments are doing so that we will not wake up one day and are totally enslaved.
I know that some of the forms of harassment that you will be addressing include gang stalking or organized stalking and electronic forms of harassing, electronic control. That sort of thing is very important indeed. And I understand that you have had personal experience yourself with some of these forms of harassment as a targeted individual.
Yes, well, I'm a long-term victim. For me, it started in 1997, so that's after I left the company. I don't think the people in that company were very very happy that I left. And since that time, my life totally changed. It was a slow build-up where I was getting more and more paranoid, made paranoid, deprived of my sleep. It made in the year 2000, and then it bursted out in 24 hours a day, second by second, I can say, what you call organized stalking or groups, gang stalking, or in German you call it Zersetzung. And that continued the whole time. It was extremely difficult. I recovered, it took me 5 years to adapt to the situation. In that 5 years, I was just merely surviving. And then in the year 2006, I started writing on the internet about these problems, first in Dutch, because there was nothing in the Netherlands about this. And from that moment on, when I published my first website about this, I was also extremely attacked electronically with microwave weapons and directed energy weapons, etc. So I have been gone really through, I think, almost all kind of harassment there has been, there exists.
Peter, what led to your being targeted? I mean, it's very unusual, it seems to me, in that therefore there must have been something distinctive about your history or situation.
Yes, well, I did university, and after university I started my own company together with a few other people. And then after a number of years, we decided to stop this company, and I started working for other companies. And the second company I worked for was a new startup company. I was asked to start it up together. I was a technical director, and there was also a CEO and a marketing director. Marketing and sales director, and we started this company up. There was a lot of money available. It was the initiator was one of the richest people in the Netherlands, and after 3 months, we had a large building, and we had 35 people personnel. It was an IT outsourcing company, so the idea was that from this network center, a network operating center, a NOC. We would manage the IT infrastructure of other companies, big companies, medium-sized companies, small companies, and that was a very nice idea. So but they also promised me some things, and well, they did not deliver. So I decided to leave. I decided to quit, And I think that was a reason for them to start attacking me. I believe when you are working for these kind of people who are belong to the top richest people in the country, you're being watched very, very carefully. And they may attack you when you decide not to go along with them. So maybe it's also good to tell that after a few years, you're just thinking about what could have been the reason for this. There was also an American, person working there. And at a certain time, there was something on the radio about the CIA. And we started joking about it. I don't know exactly what it was. But then he told me this story that he had a friend working for the NSA. And his friend, he asked his friend one day, how can I contact you? And his friend from the NSA was laughing to him. And he said, well, you just pick up a phone, any phone. You shout my name, and I will pick up the phone on the other side. So this was in 1997. So probably this whole network of surveillance was already in place then. Yeah, so I think this was this company and this whole thing was Dutch Secret Service, NSA, CIA, whatever, set up. And I'm just a person who has my own mind, and I don't think they may have found the security risk when I left this company.
Well, but do they think you had secret information, Peter? I mean, dude, what? It's very strange to me, you know, why you should have been targeted.
I don't think I had, very specific information. Well, I was not really thinking about this information. Of course, I had certain information that was more related to how the people at the highest level, the richest people, communicate with each other. And I was not part of them. I was not in their team. I did not go play golf with them. So that may have been very much the reason. I mean, if you go along with these people and you just accept their job offers and their nice pay, then everything is okay. But I did the opposite. So
what type of products or services were they providing that would have led them to believe that you would be a threat of some sort?
Well, it's not about the services. I told you it was a network operating center where that has meant that you connect many other companies to this network operating center and they manage the IT infrastructure of these companies. So that's wonderful because in that way you also manage all the data of all these companies. I think it's more that they think you. I mean, I am not rich. My father was not part of the elite or whatever. My father was not rich, so we had. I think they were just afraid that I may maybe talk about the conversations we had and tell maybe very specific things, which are not really that important. I mean. Many people who know, of course, how these things are going. But, yeah, there are a lot of things going on. And when rich people talk to each other, I mean, they don't talk like, I'm going to now go to the shop and buy some food. I mean, they talk about, I want to be the richest person in the Netherlands or make more millions or how are we going to do that? And, yeah, okay, I know some of these information, but I don't find it that shocking. I think it's just I was not part of the gang. I think you can say that, and they knew I would never be part of the gang. Yeah.
Tell me more about other cases with which you become familiar in which these electronic techniques have been employed.
Yeah, well, since I started writing on the internet, I was contacted by many people, and in the year 2007, I decided. I was thinking, what can I do to expose this problem? Because I knew it was extremely difficult. As an individual, you are alone. And there were many people contacting me already because of my website from over the world. And then I started the Stobic Foundation. And then many, many more people came to me and contacted me. What can we do? What should we do? And so I know from certain people that this electronic harassment, so this attack of the body already started in beginning of 1990s. I don't know exactly what you mean, because there is so many things going on. These people, they contact me, they are tortured. Most of them are tortured 24 hours a day. So these directed energy weapons, as they call them, so that's microwave weapons, laser weapons, extremely low frequency weapons. These frequency weapons, they pressurize you. You have sound weapons, ultrasound weapons. They attack the human body and the human mind in many different ways. And
How do you believe these individuals have been selected? Do you think they're just random targets, or that it was actually very deliberate that they have been targeted for harassment?
Yeah, I think many people are just touching the system. That's what I believe. So I know also of a person here in the Netherlands. He was in a school, and at that moment there was a person. He was a director of NATO at that moment, I believe. And they were visiting that school for some reason, I don't know exactly what. And his security personnel pushed him away, and he said, "Hey, don't push me away. Let me be here." And what happened after that? I mean, from the next day on, he was being attacked. So yes, some people, they have written a document to a school that something was not right, or to a company. They discovered a certain product was not right. And other people, they just touch the system. But in general, it's weird that you really don't know in the beginning what you did wrong. After only thinking back, you can say, okay, probably it was this, probably it was that. But I think in many cases, because on many of these people is experimented, you're just selected more or less random. Yeah, so you touch the system, they look at your status, your position. And after they make a selection if you will be in this program, because this is a program. This is a program to develop new methods, new technologies. It's a program to recruit new agents, because for every person that's targeted, new agents around such a person are recruited. And it's a program to develop new weaponry, electronic weaponry.
Do you believe then that this is an extension of the COINTELPRO program or Zur Zeitung in Germany?
Yeah, this is very much a continuation of the COINTELPRO. So that's the counterintelligence program of the FBI, it was. Many things in this program has been officially stopped, but it still continues. And the same is true for MKUltra. MKUltra is a mind control program run by the CIA, where they experimented upon people with drugs, but also with electronic devices. They implanted first into animals electrodes and see how they could control their brain. And later on, they also did this with people, although they did not say so. And both these programs were most part forbidden, but they continue till this day and are, in fact, much more sophisticated than today.
Of course, most of the country, indeed the world, has been troubled by the revelations from Edward Snowden about the massive surveillance that's being conducted virtually 24/7 of our email, our phone calls, our financial and our medical transactions. The government tries to suppress this information. When Admiral Poindexter first announced the Total Information Awareness Program in 2001, it sounded so Orwellian that they immediately changed the name to Terrorist Information Awareness. But Peter, nothing actually changed except the name. And, of course, the terrorist attacks that have been alleged to take place, particularly here in the United States, but also it appears elsewhere in the world, such as Charlie Hebdo, all appear to be fabricated, staged, or faked to some degree or another. Could you elaborate along these lines?
Yeah, well, I think the Patriot, so the event on 9/11 were very much created to get us into what I say, what I believe is the final stage of enslavement of humanity. About 50 years ago, 100 years ago, the government was maybe 50 kilometers away. They came to collect your taxes once in a while. Then about 40 years ago, you got these computer telephony switches they installed everywhere, and then they were maybe 5 kilometers away. Then with the introduction of the personal computer, the government came into your living room, and with the introduction of the mobile phone maybe 10, 15 years ago, the government is almost into your head. So this is going very fast at the moment, and this technology enslavement, I believe, has been planned already for maybe two decades by the elite. And like I told you, in 1997, I had this comment from this person, American guy working in that company where I worked, about the NSA, that they were already doing all these phone taps. So 9/11 was just meant to introduce all these new laws, and that's why they created all these terrorist things, etc. So that they could continue with the last phase of this program.
Yes, yes. We've had shootings and purported terrorist activities in Tucson and Aurora, Sandy Hook, the Boston bombing, Charleston, most recently in Virginia. Each of those I have investigated has turned out to be flimsy, a contrived event. Very frequently, Sandy Hook and the Boston bombing, no one died at Sandy Hook. No one died at the Boston bombing. The police in Boston were even calling out on bullhorns. This is a drill. This is a drill. The Boston Globe, one of the world's great newspapers, was tweeting that a demonstration bomb would be set off during the marathon for the benefit of bomb squad activities. And a second tweet that one would be set off in a minute in front of the library, and 1 minute later in front of the Boston Public Library, one is set off. And these were very, very flimsy devices. Peter, I was an artillery officer in the Marine Corps, and those explosions weren't powerful enough to have killed anyone. And when you study the photographs of the smoke and look in on the individuals lying on the ground, yes, they are missing limbs, but there is no blood. There's no blood at all, which Lorraine Day, MD, who is the head of trauma surgery at San Francisco General Hospital, has observed is physiologically impossible. Indeed, the blood is set down later. It's Hollywood blood. It comes out of tubes. And we now have photographs of other persons there who are carrying the prostheses for the amputee actors who are participating so they could reattach them to walk normally and so forth after they had done their performance. I can't believe a great nation has been reduced to this level, Peter.
No, it's really amazing that this can go on. All this events that they create, it's to distract us, and the surveillance that has been put in place was first necessary. That's why the Patriot Act was so important, because after the war in Iraq, when this all started, when the Twin Tower attack started, they could do all these new laws that allowed all the secret services they could do almost anything. In fact, the Patriot Act is a declaration of war on all the citizens in the world, all the people in the world. It's really amazing that the governments in the world have accepted this, governments in Europe. How could they accept this Patriot Act? Because, I mean, the Patriot Act says we can attack anyone, everywhere, in any country, at any moment, if we have any suspicion. Yeah? And the governments in Europe and in the world accepted this. This was, in fact, an outrage. And from that moment on, these new laws allowed the secret services to more intensely tap all our information. And that's very essential. If you want to do these kind of events, if you want to do these kind of events and you want to keep them secret, then you must know all information. You must know who's calling who. You must know where the phone calls go, who's putting what on the internet. And that's what they achieved with this, I think, with this Twin Tower attack and all the laws that they created. And that's why it's become much more easy to do all these events. Normally, we would be able to investigate, but they are so efficient. I mean, they are so extremely efficient. They have all this. I mean, if people call each other, lines are disconnected, or you know about certain of these events that have been occurring, that where people were shot in the throat and they could not speak. You know it from yourself. So they have become extremely efficient in doing all these events. And the eavesdropping and the tapping of all information is essential for this, to do this.
Yes, I think you're absolutely right that the advance of technology has brought with it new modes of surveillance and control, including mind control and harassment, and that it seems there's no form of technology that tyrants will not abuse. Where your conference, it seems to me, is making an important contribution by exposing that this has been taking place and by offering explanations of how it's being done, its significance, and what can be done about it. Peter, let's take a brief break here and we'll continue our conversation. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, with my special guest from the Netherlands, Peter Mooring, talking about the covert harassment conference to be held in Berlin the 1st and 2nd of October, just a few weeks off. We'll be right back.
We can now say with moral certainty and considerable scientific authority that the death of JFK was committed by a meticulously executed conspiracy which was obscured by an extensive cover-up. Murder in Dealey Plaza, edited by James Fetzer, goes to the heart of the JFK assassination. You'll read new and up-to-date information regarding the Secret Service, the Lincoln limousine, the medical evidence, the cover-up, altering the film, framing the patsy, and the silent historians. Also, 16 smoking guns, each one crushing the government's lone assassin scenario. A world-class chronology of November 22nd, 1963. Chapters by David W. Mantic, Gary Aguilar, Vincent Palomara, Douglas Weldon, Jack White, Ira David Wood III, James H. Fetzer, Doug Horn, and a classic essay by Bertrand Russell. The complete story in the pages of one single book, edited by James H. Fetzer. Read it now. Read it again. You'll use it as a reference. Murder in Dealey Plaza. Available at Amazon.com and major bookstores around the world. It's murder.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host, continuing my conversation with Peter Mooring about the covert harassment conference in Berlin on the 1st and 2nd of October. Peter, you have been thinking about the advances of technology and the difference it makes in issues like this. Please continue.
Yes, what many people, thank you, Jim, what many people do not understand is, I mean, we have only computers now, baby, for 30 years, and every year these computers are becoming much more advanced, much more faster, getting processing more memory, processing more data. And the human body also is a bioelectric transmitter and receiver. And what has been happened in the last decades is that the human body and the human brain have been decoded. And many people say, no, there are still secrets. But many secrets are kept away from us. They are called state security. For example, in the 60s, the Russians developed a radio wave device, just a kind of radio, and they called it the LIDA machine, the LIDA, and they pointed it at a person, and that person would fall asleep immediately. And then the Americans investigated such a device, they got one from the Russians, and they came to the same conclusions, and that was it. And then nothing was heard of this device again. And I'm sure that this device has been used many times, for example, to cause car accidents. I mean, if they put this sleep beam, as you call it, on you, then I can assure you, not from my own experience, it's incredibly difficult to stay awake and to stay driving. Sometimes I just have to park my car. And so this all this information about these advancements in technology, the decoding of the human mind, the decoding of the brain, of the body, they are kept away from us. The Snowden leaks, for example, I will give you another example. The Snowden leaks revealed in maybe 2013 or 14, that Secret Service were also attacking people in games, games in the that you can play via the internet. That was revealed in 2013, but when this started for me, I was playing the game The Sims, and it was also connected to the internet, and I drove, for example, on the road to my brother, and it was dark, and there were cars behind me with only one headlight. It was all the time the same, one headlight, one rear light in front of me, behind me. And then I came at my brother's, and I played at The Sims later in the evening. And then in that game, there were people talking. I don't know if you know the game. There were people talking, and they said to me in that game, "What do you think of all those weird lights, headlights on the highway today?" Yeah. This evening. So that is a time difference of 12, 13 years where it's the secret services, the security services do certain things, have knowledge of certain things, and do these things, and the moment when the public knows about it, that's really a big difference. That's many people think also often that well, this has happened, so the USA is taking control of the world, it's an empire, and it will fall certain time at a certain moment. But I'm not so sure of it, because this decoding of the human mind and the human body has never ever happened in history before. And with this technology, they can not only attack your body, I mean, you know, a laser weapon or a microwave weapon, but they can also attack your brain. Today it's possible to force thoughts into your brain, which are almost not possible to distinguish from your own thoughts. So what's your defense against that? So this must be taken into the open, because if you don't know this, then you will be a robot. I mean, then...
Well, yeah. I'm sure it could include introducing thoughts of depression, possibly even suicidal thoughts. Having somebody fall asleep when they're driving a car, of course, would be a convenient way for them to die in an automobile accident that would be extremely difficult to trace down to its causal origins.
Yeah, so the biggest part of the population is, of course, just being programmed and fed with all this information from the mainstream media. But there are a number of people in society, which is also a significant group, who's looking for the truth and wants a better world and wants a real world. And these people, sometimes whistleblowers, sometimes activists, but just also many people in general, they will be attacked with all this new technology. And it has become so easy to attack people with this. I mean, they can... I know this again from my own experience. I mean, they can, if I think of a certain song, they can make people opposite me started singing this song. That's totally insane. They do this to torture me. And they can, you can think of many scenarios. So they can plant a thought into your brain, but they can also plant the same thought into another brain. You talk about someone. You think of talking to someone about Amnesty International or Human Rights Watch, and then suddenly that person starts talking about this. And it's just almost a random person. So this is really a very big threat for humanity, because how do you know that if these thoughts are really your own thoughts?
Yes, that's really quite remarkable, even stunning. Yeah. Peter, I think that what you are doing by organizing this conference is of extraordinary importance. And I'm just very glad that it's taking place. Tell me a bit about the first conference in 2014.
Yeah, the first conference in 2013 I got that idea because at a certain moment I had so many contacts with people on the internet, so many victims that they're called targeted individuals, and I thought, well, all these people are in fact isolated, and as an individual you have no chance, you will be ignored as an individual. So I started doing these meetings, I called them TI meetings, targeted individual meetings, so where people, real people, could meet, and I think it was a good idea. So I did a number of these meetings in the Netherlands, and then I did a meeting in the UK, and I did, together with another organization in Germany, I did a number of meetings in Germany, and I can say that all these people were happening, that were happy that this finally was taking place, so that they could meet other victims, and hopefully we together would be inspired to find some solutions at least. So after having done a number of these meetings, I got the idea, so now we must connect the people from Europe. And that's
Where was the first conference held?
The first conference was in Brussels on November 20 last year.
Wonderful.
As a coincidence, well, you can say, because you also often talk about false flags and the incidents that can happen at certain moments. There was also a targeted individual in the U.S. His name was Myron May, and he was a special person. He was a lawyer, and he discovered he was being targeted, and he decided that he did not want to live anymore. So he recorded a number of videos, and then he did a shooting, and the shooting was, in fact, it was in the U.S., but in fact, it was on the day of the conference of last year. So this is
really
scary.
Really?
So if they want, so this is of course horrible for this person. I mean, but I want, this also indicates that if they want to do a shooting at a certain moment, they can get anyone to do this at a certain moment.
Yes, I suspect that's exactly right, and that some of the shootings we've been talking about, such as in Aurora, the theater shooting, is probably one that was committed by an individual under mind control. That seems to me a striking example. Sirhan, of course, who was the patsy in the Bobby Kennedy shooting, appears to have been under classic hypnotic mind control, where a psychiatrist boasted of having hypnotized him while working for the CIA. So I think we have a variety of techniques that have only become more sophisticated with these advances in technology that you are addressing.
Exactly. It will start when a person asks you maybe a question about a certain company or a certain event, then they will feed you with email about that is related. Then they will put some thoughts into your mind. They put some other person that appears to suddenly to be a friend of you and wants to know more information about a certain thing. But this technology makes a lot of things a lot easier. It's undetectable and invisible. They can control your mind. They can control your body. They can do this through wall. In a home, you can use your mobile phone within four walls of your home. So that's the frequencies going in and out, and you can also have weaponry based on these frequencies that go to in and out.
Have you looked into the role of smart meters too, Peter? That smart meters seem to be a way of surveying what's going on within a house.
No, I did not really look into smart meters, but I think any device that is connected into your home, you should try to avoid this. Yeah, even Wi-Fi is extremely dangerous.
Now, Peter, I know you're not putting on this conference unassisted, and that you have a co-organizer with you now. Could you please introduce her so we might speak about the conference and her background?
Yes, of course I'm not doing the conference alone. That's impossible. It's so much work. I have a number of people who really help, do wonderful jobs. So and one of them is Beata Zalewska, and I will be happy to get out and to ask Beata to come sit here.
Okay? Please, terrific. Thank you, Peter.
Hello, Tim.
Hello, Beata. I'm so pleased to have a chance to speak with you. Tell me, how did you first become interested and knowledgeable about these issues?
It's quite difficult to explain, but the first time I heard of the phrase electronic harassment when it was in 2011, I was attending I was a member of a TSL workshop, and there was a person who joined us, and she said she experiences electronic harassment. I researched this, and I came across of the stories of targeted individuals, and I came across of a number of very serious articles written about it that would describe it as an electronic torture. But since then, I sort of was very much occupied. I was very busy. I worked at the time for the Transport for London company. I worked in the office, and at the same time, I was a student of film and media at the Birkbeck University in London. And I was an activist. I was a member of the London Guantanamo campaign. So I was very, very busy, and I would like time to really look into it. But at some point, my life started feel to me like if it's, it just felt like it's a controlled demolition, not only of my life and what is going on with my work, my studies, but as well of my personality. So I started noticing I'm losing control over my emotions, the way I behave, the way how I feel. I would be getting sick very often. I would be getting lots of stomach problems, headaches, being not suddenly able to concentrate when, for instance, I would be writing an essay on technological determinism, where I would be researching Marshall McLuhan, Canadian philosopher, who said that technology becomes like an extension of human beings. So you can look at the car extension of your legs, or your computer or phone as an extension of your memory. But it's like you really transfer some of the processes, your internal processes, like part of your memory to those devices. So you rely on them. You don't need to remember it anymore. It's there, and your brain is learned new thing to ignore remembering it. But then there were other things, like with emotions. I would start feeling very stressed all the time, very angry for a number of months, all the time with everyone around me. Or suddenly it would be extreme depression. So I would just want to lie down in bed and cry and think over and over and look for the worst moments in my life and think them over and over. Then there was a period of very extremely bizarre sexual fantasies as well, and that was very distracting, and it would appear suddenly. Like I would go to work, be at work, function normal, then come back from work, and although having it planned that after work I will focus on my studies and carry on with this, or that I will focus on my research for the Guantanamo campaign and carry on with this, and suddenly I would start having those nasty thoughts that would be dragging me into bizarre sexual fantasies, and it was very difficult to resist, and it was sort of driving me to the point when I was feeling like I'm really losing control over my sanity, and how is that possible? I never thought I can ever become an insane person, and at the same time, it was difficult still to distinguish because I was very busy, and I was as well very much attacked like with things like I would feel like I'm getting a flu, I would be getting colds, or I would be getting nauseas, diarrhea problems, and lots of other things would be happening in the meantime. So it was very sophisticatedly arranged around my life. But overall, it felt like a controlled demolition of life and personality. And I my feeling now, retrospectively, is that they do have ability now to do it to a person, especially if someone is young, in a way that the person does not notice, until they don't want the person to notice it.
How did you manage to work your way to the point where you felt that it was important to go public with these issues, to do something about it? How did you and Peter first to connect?
Well, I was brought to the point of a suicide. I was very, very often suicidal. And although I considered myself as an agnostic person at the time, even if atheistic, there was a time in my life in 2010 when I would be very atheistic and very outspoken on various social media, on the internet, but I think that was a bit mind control as well right now. But inside me, I always felt that there is something spiritual, and I did not agree with all those thoughts that were coming to me to kill myself, and I could not understand, and I couldn't understand why am I thinking this if overall I love life despite any difficulties. Life is a wonderful opportunity to express yourself, to meet other beings on this planet, and I was always very grateful for it, even despite the difficulties and problems. So I couldn't understand it, and I begged the universe to let me find out what's going on. And then one of the next days, I just came across of the video that one of the UK whistleblowers, former Secret Service agent Barry Trower, recorded very in-depth talk. It was called The Cooking of Humanity. And when I listen to that, and everything what Barry Trower was saying, how it feels to you when they use on your microwave weapons, it's really explained to me. This is the only explanation. So I started research this more, and I came across of the Peter's website, and I contacted him. And that was at the time when I suddenly had an opportunity to meet with a psychologist in London. And my psychologist suggested that it is beyond her competencies, and she suggested I should see a psychiatrist. So I said, can I please consider it? And I, in emergency, traveled to Netherlands. I met with Peter, and we talked. And Peter printed for me an article written by psychologist Carol Smith about all those weapons. And then I came back to London. I met with my psychologist. I presented that article, and I said that I definitely know I'm not insane. I'm absolutely sure that there is some external force that interferes with not only my body but also my mind. And I asked my psychologist to look into it. She did, and after a week, well, actually since then, during the therapy, there would be no mention about psychiatrists anymore, and she eventually would admit that she very much believes me. And then I had also managed to convince one of my fantastic teachers, I don't know whether I can mention her name, but she's a wonderful person from the Birkbeck University in London. I talked to her, and I think she believed me very much. I got extensions for my assignments because I struggled to submit them on the third year, although on the first year there was no problems with me submitting any assignments, and I was considered one of the best students.
Yeah, it must have made a huge difference when you discovered there were others in a similar position to you, and that there was an explanation that you had not even imagined in the past.
Yes, Peter very much inspires me. Peter taught me a lot. I have to admit that I did not notice that much before I met Peter, because before I lived in London is a very chaotic town, full of people, totally full. So I would not really pay attention to the stalking. Although it was very bizarre to notice around me when I worked for transport in London, all the time there would be people around me on the tube, on the bus, and the place where I would go to have lunch. People around me would be talking all the time about personality disorders. That would really be playing on my mind, but at the same time, I always thought, whatever other people are talking about is their business, I'm not going to care about it. So I would not be paying much attention to what is going on around me. And when I met Peter, he taught me to pay attention to this as well. And it really started to shock me over the last year how much other things are happening, how many other things are synchronized with what I'm doing or thinking. So if I am thinking of something, then there is a reaction outside from either the neighbors or people who pass the street, like some kind of noise, or even with the animals. It's really bizarre and extremely difficult to explain. And yeah, that's why it's a struggle. And apart that, there's the whole, from what I've realized now over a year, the whole movement of TIs is extremely infiltrated. There's many TIs who spend years in a psychiatric hospital, they were drugged with many medications, etc. So they might not be able to explain it in the right way. They might not even be able to understand it in the right way after all these years of medication. But and then there are also perpetrators who just intentionally misguide and misinform. So it's very, very difficult, and that is why I'm very grateful to Peter. He helps me to realize it and start recognizing this, and that I'm now able to slowly be able to distinguish when I'm controlled, when I'm not, or not always. Sometimes it's really bizarre, it's difficult to explain. You think you are thinking, but then after a while when you think back, you realize that maybe that thought was actually induced to you to distract you from another thing you were doing. So it's we really entered very difficult time on Earth.
I think this is all utterly fascinating, and that it requires immense integrity and courage to go public with your and Peter's experiences, for which I admire you beyond words. I think organizing this conference is a simply splendid idea and has enormous potential to make the world aware of what is going on. So if Peter is there, I would like to conclude with a further discussion of the conference in which you're assisting him, Beata. Thank you so much for coming on to speak with me.
Hi, Jim.
Peter, more and more, I think what you're doing is of enormous significance. Tell us more about the speakers you'll have at the conference and the objectives you want to accomplish by means of this international event in Berlin on the 1st and 2nd of October.
Yes. Last conference was very much about TIs, because it was the first time, but in fact the problem of the targeted individuals goes beyond the targeted individuals. These are the people who have been selected and who are experimented upon and who help, well, between quotes, to develop all this new weaponry. So thinking of this, I thought we not only now address the TIs, but we want to get the message out that this is not only a TI problem, but this is in fact a problem of the whole world. We must get this information out. It's a little bit weird that if the targeted individuals would save themselves, would find a way to save themselves, then they would in fact save the world. It's a little bit like that, because all this technology must be exposed. It's extremely important that it must be exposed. So this year on the conference, we have 2 days. On day one, we talk about the covert war against humanity. So that's more the general thing, where these technology issues are addressed. And on the second day, we talk about the covert war against individuals. So then we get both things on a single conference. Yeah, we have wonderful speakers this year. many speakers also. So our keynote speaker is Nick Begich. He will talk about HARP and electromagnetic mind control, very important. He wrote books about controlling the human mind, and he wrote his book Angels Don't Play This HARP. So he will do quite a long presentation. But we have other wonderful speakers as well, like Moimir Babacek. I think we also already talked about this at the beginning. We have Ole Damegaard, who talks about false flags. Very important. This is all interwoven. We talk about we have Ole Johansson, who talks about the Wi-Fi and how it can be misused. There are many speakers. Kevin Barrett, of course, will be there. He will be speaking also about this technology and the targeted individuals. So, I mean, you can go to the conference website and you will see all these wonderful speakers. It's wonderful team, people who will come to the conference and speak there.
Tell us the name of the website, Peter.
Yeah, the website is the URL is covertharassmentconference.com.
Going there now.
So, there are all the speakers. You see all the speakers there. I don't know if you know David Dees.
Nick Begich, whom you mentioned, Ole Damegaard, Kevin Barrett, Ole Johansson, John Hall, Henning Witt, Harold Breams, yourself, of course. Can you tell me something about some of them?
Yeah, Harold Breams is the founder of the Initiative Gegen Elektromagnetische Folter. So he is in fact also an organization like Stopac, but then in Germany. Then we have Stopset. Eva Pavela, she represents Stopset. After the conference of last year, a number of people in Poland joined together and started an organization also about this problem in Poland. So, and I think it's a wonderful thing because now this year, last year we did this conference with two organizations in Europe. So UKESH, which is the European Coalition Against Covert Harassment, and STOPAC. But this year we do it with four organizations organizing. So where we have been kept apart for so many years, yeah, we are not only now the TIs, the targeted individuals, are uniting, but we also show the world that these organizations can work together despite all the difficulties that are introduced, all the distrust that is introduced. Like Beata said, there's many disinformation, many things are infiltrated, but still we managed to organize this conference together as a group of people, and I think it's wonderful.
And tell us, too, Peter, about what you hope to achieve with the Harassment Conference 2015.
Well, what we hope to achieve is that we involve more people outside the TI community, because we think that's very important. We involve more people into this problem, because this problem must be exposed. It's not only the problem of the TIs. Of course, it's horrible. They are tortured. Many are tortured 24 hours a day. Some are cooked, burned, mind controlled. They get pain. They lay on the ground the whole day. Many are literally cooked out of their homes. They sleep in cars. Their internet is broken. Their phones are broken. But this is also the problem is also about this exposing all this advanced technology, these methods to control the population. And like I told you, it is different from history. It is not. I don't think the empire will fall this easy, because the last decades, the human body and brain have been decoded. And if you can control the human, then what are you going to do? How are you going to fight it? So we want to expose both the terrible situation of the target individuals and the extreme advances that have been made in technology that will allow other people, a very small group of people, control, remotely control, part of the population.
And I know you also want to discuss how to protect people who are being targeted themselves, how they can realize or understand what's going on and what they can do to cope with it.
Yes, yes. Maybe I can give some words, have Beata to speak some words about this, because she has been preparing this also for the conference. So if you have one moment.
Yeah. Sure, of course, yes. Yeah.
Hello, Jim.
Yes, Beata, please continue.
This year we also will hold a solutions forum. Well, the program this year will be extremely, extremely tense. So we would like everyone to be sort of flexible about it and understanding that things can still change. It's very tense and lots of things will be happening. It will be from morning to evening. And on the second day of the conference, we will hold a solutions forum, and during the solutions forum I will present a number of videos. It's difficult to find a solution for such a complex problem. The complex is extremely complex, like Peter said, like never before in a history. That was never a case that a state could enter our mind, an individual mind. If we will lose a freedom of mind, we will lose what the meaning of humanity is. This is extremely important to realize. And that's what one of the aims of the conference. And we still have internet. And technology is like knife. You can kill someone, but you can also make a sandwich and save someone's life. So we hope that wise people like yourself, like Kevin Barrett, like James Tracy, will come on board, and we encourage other journalists and other people who can help us, like you, brave people. We encourage them. We encourage whistleblowers to come forward and support it, because this is the only chance to save the world from the old policies and plans that UN, NATO, and the elites of the world are now imposing, and they're going very fast. The world machine is building very fast.
I can't thank you and Peter enough for coming on the show today. I know your objectives include informing the people of the world what is really going on, finding ways to protect the people who are attacked. Your website, covertharassmentconference.com, online. I look forward to doing a subsequent interview with you and some of your speakers on the 30th of September. I can't thank you enough for being here. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, thanking Beata and Peter for being here. Stand by for the new JFK show with Gary King.
We can now say with considerable scientific authority that the death of JFK was committed by a meticulously executed conspiracy which was obscured by an extensive cover-up. Murder in Dealey Plaza, edited by James Fetzer, goes to the heart of the JFK assassination. You'll read new and up-to-date information regarding the Secret Service, the Lincoln limousine, the medical evidence, the cover-up, altering the film, framing the patsy, and the silent historians. Also, 16 smoking guns, each one crushing the government's lone assassin scenario. A world-class chronology of November 22nd, 1963. Chapters by David W. Mantic, Gary Aguilar, Vincent Palomara, Douglas Weldon, Jack White, Ira David Wood III, James H. Fetzer, Doug Horn, and a classic essay by Bertrand Russell. The complete story in the pages of one single book, edited by James H. Fetzer. Read it now. Read it again. You'll use it as a reference. Murder in Dealey Plaza. Available at Amazon.com and major bookstores around the world. It's murder.
Less than 3% of you people read books. But less than 15% of you read newspapers. Right now, there is a whole, an entire generation that never knew anything that didn't come out of this tube. This tube can make or break presidents, popes, prime ministers. Television is not the truth. Television is a circus, a carnival, a traveling troupe of acrobats, storytellers, dancers, singers, jugglers, sideshow freaks, lion tamers, and football players. We deal in illusions, man. None of it is true. But you people sit there day after day, night after night, all ages, colors, creeds.
Broadcasting live on Network Radio.
So turn off your television set. Turn them off now. Turn them off and leave them off.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade.
It looks like one of those scenes of an old building being purposely dynamited and blown.
When we are successful,
I'm just a patsy.
And we will be.
We're ready to make to come to the microphone, so we'll listen up.
A new world order.
So my name's Robbie Parker.
It might have appeared that way, but from my close-up inspection, there's no evidence of a plane having crashed anywhere near the Pentagon.
Let us never tolerate outrageous conspiracy theories concerning the attacks of September the 11th.
President Kennedy died at 1 p.m.
Live from the Media Broadcasting Center.
Welcome to the new JFK Show number 73. Our show is such a success that we had many comments on the video, on the YouTube video, that they said we needed more. So we had to have Robert back one more time. So we're going to talk about Z film alteration. We've got Larry Rivera, who's going to bring new research. Now, let me just tell everyone who doesn't happen to know, no one beats Larry Rivera when it comes to new JFK research. It's as simple as that. So we're happy to have, in my mind, the top researcher who's most active. And I have a lot of great researchers. This guy is digging in right now, day and night. So welcome to the show, fellas. We've got Don Fox. We've got Chance in the engineer's chair once again. We're going to have Larry Rivera, and we've got Robert Morningstar. So he's got a slideshow to give us, and we're going to turn it over to Robert. Go ahead, Robert.
Hey, thank you very much. Thank you very much. When it comes to the Zapruder film, I'm the proponent of explaining the alterations in terms of psychology. I called it gestalt editing. One of the things that I studied in college in which I chose to specialize is gestalt psychology, which is the psychology of human perception. It's a psychology developed in Germany that determined how a human being forms an idea by organizing visual information, basically geometrically. And knowing how the mind works, the German psychologists of the 20s, 30s, in particular the 30s in Nazi Germany, had the capacity to compose, for example, a poster or a film that would make everyone who saw it have the same thought at the same time, and each one of them believing that it was their own individual private thought. Okay? That's the basic mind control apparatus. To show an image to a million people, and all of them having the same reaction and thinking that it's their own personal reaction rather than the manipulation of their senses. And this is what we have in the Zapruder film. Last week I mentioned the story of my first viewing of the Zapruder film when it was shown on CBS and cut off just before the headshot. However, I watched it twice. I mentioned that the first time I thought I blinked, so I watched it again at 11 o'clock. And to my amazement, I blinked at exactly the same point, which left me in a kind of confused state of mind. It's called cognitive dissonance because it absolutely made no sense that I could be concentrating 100% at 7 o'clock and actually, like the launch of the shuttle Challenger, 104% at 11 o'clock. The upshot is this. They covered up these three frames in 1969 when they showed the film for the first time on CBS. These three frames were blacked out by a black frame. So the film had the effect of making me think that I blinked because I didn't perceive the black frame. It took 30 years for me to find that copy of the Zapruder film and find this section blacked out. Why? Because they didn't have the courage to show this to the American public, even on television, for fear that somebody with fast eyes, which is what I describe my vision as, not just sharp, acute, quick. What I'm going to do here is explain to you how the optical illusion was created, that the car did not stop and that in fact it accelerated. In these three frames, you'll see splice marks. I marked them. See 207, splice mark, right across the border of the sign, and in a horizontal form. Notice that it is not exactly at the halfway point. Then we have the second frame, Z212. Now you see a jump, Z207 to Z212. And this is because they admitted then that the film had been damaged and frames had been lost here. They claimed only five frames, but that's a farce. What actually happened took a lot more frames than just five damaged frames. But here is where the illusion was created. Knowing the principles of Gestalt psychology and physics and how the human being's eye perceives motion, they were able to reverse the principles of Gestalt psychology and reverse engineer this film into fooling us all for 30 years that the car didn't stop, the car accelerated, was one smooth flow, no interruption. Well, that is total farce, falsehood. And any of the testimony of the witnesses all describe a near stop and a complete stop. So let me explain to you how the illusion of continuous motion was created. If you're moving in a fast moving vehicle, especially a high one, let's say a train, and you look close by, you'll see the terrain moving by very quickly, almost in a blur. Look a little farther away and you may even see the area, I'm thinking about running on a train through the countryside, it kind of looks like it moves around in a circle. And if you look far away, you see that everything is moving very slowly. So things that are near move very quickly, things that are far move very slowly. Well, knowing this principle of human perception and actual reality, they were able to fool our peripheral visions by moving the porch. They cut out a section that they didn't want us to see, which is probably President Kennedy lurching up in the seat. William Newman said he saw him hit and stand up as if he was going along with a gag or something. Zapruder said he saw his head pop up above the sign. You see Jackie's bonnet there. You don't see Jack. So Jack, for his head to rise above the level of the sign for Zapruder to see it, had to have lurched up in his seat, which is quite credible if somebody shot in the back, which is the shot between the shoulder blades. That was the first shot. So they delete this lift and drop while the car is stopped. And by slicing the film here, removing, I estimate, several feet of film in that action, they interpose the partial frame in the second one where you see Z212. Notice that the corner of the porch, which is aligned with the sign in the first frame, the corner of the porch is aligned with the tree trunk, the base of the tree trunk. You see the tree on the right in the first frame? Well, that tree trunk is now right over the flag. You see? And the effect in keeping the porch where it is, removing several feet of film, the car looks like has lurched out. It has accelerated, but the acceleration is false. In the first frame, you see two headlights, the far left headlights and a piece of the flag. In the second one, you see the entire grill in 1/18th of a second. No car could move that fast in 1/18th of a second. But the illusion of continuous motion is created by the juxtaposition of the porch, the trunk of the tree, and the flag. Now, this is how it works in terms of Gestalt psychology. When we look at the first picture, we organize the information of that picture on a horizontal line and on a vertical line. This is how we have ground, horizon. We have sky and we have ground. So your eye is used to this. And in this configuration here, geometrically, you see that the line of the porch is aligned with the right signpost, the upright, and the tree is on the right side. These are parallels. We have these parallels, the sign, the porch, the tree. In the second frame, which is artificial, we have the porch, the tree, the flag, which has preserved the vertical line, the vertical reference that our eyes are seeing in frame Z207. However, the bottom has been shifted. The sign has moved rapidly to the left. The car has accelerated, apparently, but it really hasn't. It's creeping. It's crawling. And the creep and the crawl has been removed to make the whole grill jump out and fool us into thinking that that's acceleration. But this is not complete. In the next frame, more of the car has emerged, but the porch has been slid back to where it belongs. You see? In the third frame, the corner of the porch is aligned with the upright of the sign, and the tree is back in place and slightly behind the flag. These three frames demonstrate the greatest example of mass mind control that the world has ever seen. Do you understand, gentlemen? By shifting the upper part of the frame very rapidly, they fooled our peripheral visions as if we were riding on a train, and the train slid to a slow, slow crawl, and somehow, with some power, was able to move a mountain in the far background, 20 miles away, just slide it over to make us misperceive visually acceleration and deceleration.
All right, Robert, you were saying that someone had admitted that there were a few frames that were damaged or lost. Where did that information come from?
Well, the most important information to come out in the last 20 years since I discovered this in 1992 is the work of Douglas Horn, who found a top CIA photo interpreter, Dino Brugioni, who had handled the original uncut film and worked it over that first night when it was delivered to the NPIC. I recommend Douglas Horn's work on YouTube. He explains it completely and fully. He has the whole chain of possession and the splitting of the film and the reproduction of the film and the sending of the film to Rochester to be processed. Two sets of CIA agents handling the film, recomposing the film with a storyboard. And in Mr. Horn's excellent six-hour documentary, the fifth part, I believe, is a Zapruder film, he has found storyboards. He got them. And if you look closely, the storyboard has photo, 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 photo. And in between, it says 40 frames missing, 44 frames missing. This is to give you an idea of the magnitude of the deception. 44 frames, if it were 18 frames per second, you're talking about more than 2 seconds there. Right?
Hey, would now be a good time to play the Z film?
Oh, great, sure.
Okay, we'll have Chance roll the Z film here.
Anytime.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah, Robert, the Z film is replete with missing frames. Like, we don't see the whole turn from Houston onto Elm. That whole part has been. So, I mean, we know before even any shots are fired, or anyone even has a hint of a shot being fired, there's already a bunch of frames missing.
Oh, yes. And the other thing is this. Even the turn, this same technique has been used in The Turn. You fellows are familiar with the film Frame by Frame. You know, there's that odd frame when the president's limousine appears on Elm Street with frame one, the car in the background looks like it's levitating. Now, this is vertical movement like this, you know, that's unnatural. Again, they're playing with your peripheral vision. When the car appears and the car lurches up there, it creates the illusion you saw the turn happen.
Yeah, and
this, by the way, this method is used several times in the film. This is not the only instance. You'll find another instance at 156, 155, 56, 57, and the first 130, 100 to 130. Those motorcycle cops coming down in the beginning, as I explained last week, they're moving in slow motion. That is a strip of film that has been shot in slow motion. They were coming around normally like normal cops do, just cruising around. But that, I can recognize it, as I mentioned last week, I had, and I have a Zapruder film camera. It's actually a Bell & Howell Electronic Guy movie camera. And I know the quality of film and motion when the movie shot in slow motion, as Zapruder claimed he had shot it at 24 frames per second.
Yeah, do we have Larry with us, fellas?
I'm here.
Yeah, go ahead and chime in there, Larry.
Hello, Larry.
Hey, how you doing? How's everybody doing tonight?
Great.
Let's just advance the slides. We got a lot to cover here.
Right. Let's go with the slides. I'll show you a couple of possibilities. We're going to go through this series of slides. These slides that you see here have been removed, actually, in the collection that John Costella has put on his website. Those have been replaced by whole frames. But I remind you that these whole frames that you see here, they were recomposed and reconstructed in 1997 in that MLM production, to recall, where they computerized the film, they reshot it, they blended it, they lightened up the lines. However, the point I'm going to make here is about things that they were covering up. I mentioned the president standing up and falling back down in the car, having been shot in the back and having said, oh my God, I've been shot, prior to the throat shot. But notice the back of the sign here. It's clear. It's clean. You see? No flaws. Let's advance the film. And before we go, look at the lady on the porch, or someone on the porch wearing a very bright red coat. Right? Look at Rosemary Willis standing still in line with, I guess it's Bobby Hargis, or the outer motorcycle cop.
B.J. Martin.
B.J. Martin, right. Well, by the way, let me tell you something. Gene Hill was going out. Let's see, was it Gene Hill or Beverly Oliver?
Gene Hill with
B.J. Martin. Was going out with B.J. Martin.
That's right.
He told me that when this happened, B.J. Martin did a complete, the sound, everything exploded. He did a complete 360, practical 360 with his motorcycle before it came crashing down to the ground. That Gene Hill told me in 1994.
It's in her book also.
Oh, great. Well, anyway, look at the back of the sign. You see there's nothing wrong with it. Now we go on to the next one. And what has happened? You see, these are frames that John Costella has put in as purported frame 208, 209, 210, 211. But these frames weren't around in 1992. This is not what was right. being shown to the general public. Notice also that the left side here is completely demolished. You know, it's obliterated. And it will remain so for the next three or four frames. 208, 209. We can go on. You'll see. Okay, look at the top of the frame. That person has disappeared in 1/18th of a second, the one with the red coat. Okay. And also the left side is completely chopped off.
I'm sure that left side, there's a great explanation
for
that.
Oh, yeah, sure. Sure, here again, but they didn't want us to see the sprocket. Again, it could be that there was information on the sprocket. Oh, here it is. The sprocket area was stamped with a code, Kodak film, Ektachrome, blah, 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 point, point, point. And if we had seen the sprocket area, we would be able to see alterations because those imprints, for example, the Kodak register and the number are at regular intervals. So you should have printing, 10 frames, printing, same thing, 10 frames, and so on. But if we were to see this uncut, you would see that those are out of joint, they're disjointed. Please continue. Next frame, again, nothing worth talking about. So we get here. Okay, now look at the back of the sign. You see the frame there? It's made to look as if the frame has been cracked by the sprocket area. However, I believe that this is an attempt, again, to cover up damage that was done to the sign by shots that went through the sign. I just recently read something, an account of Jackie Kennedy, told Jim Bishop in the day that Kennedy was shot that when she looked up, she saw pieces of the sign flying at her. I had never read that before. I've read a lot of her testimony, but this particular excerpt from the day Kennedy was shot is significant. Let's go on to the next frame.
I've heard there's a school of thought that whole sign was inserted.
Well, obviously, there's a lot of doctoring has been done. I showed you the principal doctoring, which lasted till 1997, so 34 years before they got their hands and digitized it and were able to kind of smooth it out. But right now we're doing pretty well. We can see what's happening. One of the arts of Gestalt psychology is camouflage, right? So how do you camouflage a shot, a break in the back of a sign? Oh, you make a few more scratches and make people believe that they were scratches. Continue, please. Okay. Again, look up there. Nothing. No one in a red coat. And this is supposed to be from 207 to, where are we now? About 213, 212. 212 is when it comes back. Okay, so I would say 213. So in just one third of a second, the person with the red raincoat at the top is just gone. It's impossible for a human being to move that quickly. Continue, please. And now look at what we have in the sign. Do we not have a hole in the sign? Let me tell you something else about this. This has been doctored already and tampered with because that trail, which was the first quote unquote vapor trail that I found in the original copy of the Zapruder film, a copy of which I have, which I negotiated with Silverberg, the lawyer, James Silverberg, back in 1993, I negotiated and I got a copy of Zapruder film officially, legally, so I could use it in my lectures. That trail is white. This has been darkened using Photoshop. I have Cray's supercomputer enhancements of the original frame, and I can show them to you at another time, and you'll see that this is clearly white. But look at the sign. You see the plug, the hole, whatever it is, the black mark. Again, black marks can be magic marker applied to something smaller that would appear white. What would we expect if a bullet went through the sign from either side? Whether it was shot through here or coming through the other side. We'd expect to see some sunshine, some sunlight, background of some color, perhaps. But when you black it out like that, you obliterate the sunshine coming through, you see? It's a darkening of evidence there. And again, the striations, look at the cracks coming across the back of the sign spread out. Now, the first horizontal below the black dot, look at it, it does not go through the post. But when you see the second one, it does go through the post. This is what I believe I call camouflage. We can continue.
I was going to say now, if your windshield was cracking as fast as the sign appears to be, you'd probably not get down to the end of the block before the whole thing fell apart.
Yeah. And now listen to this. This is, I consider this my masterpiece. I found this vapor trail. Subliminally, I saw it. when I went to see the film JFK, I sat in the 10th row. And as this was unfolding, and that's the Cray supercomputer enhanced version of the Zapruder film that was done by Oliver Stone. And Oliver Stone and his producer called me in 1992 after I notified the screenwriter of a theory that I had of looking for not vapor trails. I was looking for infrared trails and tracks that could have been found in the Zapruder film using infrared videography. That was my theory. That if we got an infrared camera and the Zapruder film, a real 8mm copy of it, we might be able to see areas of the emulsion that had been heated by the bullets. Lo and behold, little did I realize that the information was there. And I actually found this vapor trail when it was a tiny, tiny section of frame. I had all of frame 295. And it was going, and I saw this little wispy cloud appear between 294, 95 it was there, 95, 96 it wasn't. So I said, you know, this could be what we're looking for. So when I got the Cray supercomputer enhanced version of it, and I went to Sony Corporation, imagine 1992, 93, a digital printer was not very common. So I had to go to the Sony Corporation here in New York, and I asked them for their help and paid them for the work. And this is the inshoot and the vapor trail. Now, if you take Z295 and line this up, you put a ruler on that vapor trail, and you'll see it goes directly to Conway. Now, this is a more recent discovery. That black dot in JFK's head, which is, you know, the point of deflection. This shot was described by Secret Service man Glenn Bennett, whose testimony was that he saw the president's shot high right side of the head. You see, I think that this is what he was talking about. It was not a full inshoot. I call it a billiard ball shot, a ricochet, but apparently some damage was done. You see this little dot? Imagine if that little dot were red, how this would look. And I have actually done it. I don't show it publicly. But that's what I believe this is. So this is the first and the foremost vapor trail. This proves conspiracy beyond the shadow of a doubt, because this happens at Z295, a full second before Z313. See? That's 1 second. And again, we know it would take Oswald 2.5 seconds to do the bolt action and reset. Of course, it's a ludicrous theory that anyone could possibly do it. I would like to mention that Walter Cronkite's first words, which I've just been reviewing by going through the November 22nd broadcast of CBS, was that the president was killed in a fusillade of shots. A fusillade of shots does not mean one shot, then another shot, and then another shot. The other testimony that we have to pay attention to, and it's critical. A score of people said they thought they heard firecrackers. Now, if you guys know firecrackers like I know firecrackers from New York, Chinatown, they don't just go pop. They go pop, 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 pop.
Right? Yeah, automatic gunfire. There was reports of automatic.
Exactly. That was my thesis, you know, that this was automatic gunfire. And I had the privilege, gentlemen, this work has taken me across the country, around the world. And I actually met Jim Wright in 1994 in Chicago. Congressman Jim Wright, who was in the motorcade, was there, and I went up to him, and this was my idea, that automatic weapon fire had been used. And I approached him, and he was quite affable, and he had given a very beautiful memorial to President Kennedy of his memories of that day. And so I said to him, Congressman, I have this theory, and I'd just like to ask you a question. You heard the shots. How many shots did you think you heard? Three? More? Just, at least three. Okay, so he's being a diplomat. At least three. And I said to him, Congressman, from what you heard, do you think any of those shots could have been automatic weapons fire? And he paused a moment, and he looked at me, and he considered whether he was going to say anything. Like, you know, he sized me up, and then he said, well, yes, some of it could have been an automatic weapons fire. And that was it. I shook his hand, and I thanked him, and I walked away. Okay, that was 94. That's the same place where Dr. Crenshaw and I had a very extended conversation, where Dr. Crenshaw said to me, as I'm sure he said to many other people, and you've seen him, he said, Robert, the throat shot was no bigger, no wider than my pinky. You know, like that. And I saw Dr. Perry's tracheostomy. He was an artist. What you see in that photograph is the work of a butcher. Okay? So we can continue. I want to cover this. I think the next one, see, there's the one without the inset of the close-up. See, the prior one, if you want to show it again, is a close-up of that little black dot. But it was only when I could get my really good computer software. Actually, I use a software from 1996. I don't use Photoshop. It's something so basic, but I've learned to utilize it well. We may continue. This gives you the feeling when you see that thing disappear. You get the feeling of velocity. Now, in the wide version of this, which I did not send to you, it's the, let's call it the CinemaScope, that trail in the upper part is visible as a segmented line. White cloud in the air, then that inshoot, and then the outshoot here. And I often lay a ruler down and just watch it go right into Governor Conway. Okay, we may continue.
All right, this is starting on frame 240.
Yep.
Where we clearly shows the well-defined faces of Jackie and Governor Connolly. Mm-hmm. However, when you look at JFK's face, you can tell that it's been fleshed out and blurred, where his mm-hmm. features are indistinct, were not distinguishable at all. Mm-hmm. Now, if the attempted explanation were that Zapruder jiggled his camera in reaction to report, then why are the others not blurred as well? And right. If we go on to the next slide, which is frame 258, you can see where JFK's features are clearly distinguishable, and the other two people that are in the limousine. And if Chance can go back and forth a couple of times here real quick, 240 and then 258, you look at JFK's features and in this 240 slide of the Zapruder film, his face seems to have been blurred. So this is just something that we have recently discovered. I don't know if anybody has ever looked at this. But if you look at the prior slides of the film and after 240, this is the only one where this happens. And if you can quickly go on to the next slide, because we need to go through this pretty quickly here. This is I want to focus now on Officer Shaney and his position in the motorcade. Officer Shaney was right off to the limousine's right fender, and he's clearly seen here riding inside of the traffic line. And this is going to be very important as we go on here, because Officer Shaney, as noted by Beverly Brunson in 1968, you can see his reflections. If you go on to the next slide here, you can see his reflections clearly on the side of the limousine. Mm-hmm. And this is prior to the limousine disappearing behind the Stemmons Freeway sign. Okay. And as the limo emerges from the from behind the Stemmons Freeway sign, now we go on to the Alton 6, which is the next slide. And this is the one image that is frozen in time that is so important to what we're going to discuss here now quickly. And it corresponds to Zapruder frame 255. Okay. And 255, if you look closely here, you can see Officer Shaney off to the right of JFK. He's within arm's distance. He can practically touch the president. Go on to the next slide. Yeah, right. This one right here. And this close-up of Cheney, I mean, it's unmistakable here. You can see that he's within arm's length of the president, and he's abreast, completely abreast of him. And the next slide we have inserted for comparison basis here, Zapruder frame 255 into the Alchin 6 photograph. And this is something that Beverly Brunson noted back in 1968, where Officer Cheney, there's two issues here. Officer Cheney is not seen in Zapruder frame 255. That's number one. And number two, the reflections that had been so clearly seen prior to the limousine disappearing at behind the Stemmons Freeway sign are non-existent now. Okay, so the next slide that we're going to show here is sort of a representation here that shows where Officer Cheney should have been in relation to frame 255. Okay, and it also shows another observation by Brunson regarding that blue ink that is present on the side of the limo. In fact, if you look around, even around the area of the windshield, the tint is there's also a presence of blue ink there as well. So in Brunson's research, she noted these things, and she right away, questioned the authenticity of the Zapruder film. And we're talking about 1968. That was before it was even available as a film. And she worked exclusively on based on images that she obtained from Life magazine, for example, in the which were in color, the specifically the November 29th issue of Life, and the images that were published by the Warren Commission, which were in black and white. But regardless, she was able to detect these anomalies here in the Zapruder film. If we go on to the next slide, now a Norwegian researcher by the name of Sverre Anskog created this composite, okay, where he inserted the figure of Bobby Hargis. What he did, he was messing around, you know, probably with Photoshop, you know, and he took the image of Bobby Hargis and he inserted him in approximately in the area where he thought that Officer Cheney should have been visible in Zapruder frame 255. Okay, and this is very interesting because in a way he confirmed Beverly Brunson's research, which had been totally forgotten. I found Brunson's papers and a lot of her correspondence with Harold Weisberg at Weisberg's website, where the repository where all of his papers and documents reside at Hood College. Gerald McKnight, Dr. McKnight, is the person who has been responsible for compiling all of Harold Weisberg's work there. So anyway, there is a directory there dedicated to Beverly Brunson, and this is where I found these letters and papers that she had written regarding these issues. A lot of other things that she investigated as well. But for the what we're discussing here right now, she noted that Officer Cheney should have been present, should have been seen in Zapruder frame 255. And if we look at the next slide, this is a composite collage that I created. And this one, in this example, what I did was I just went and took Officer Cheney from frame 207, I believe, or yeah, 207, and inserted him, 205, 206, and inserted him where he should have been. And I'm pretty sure that if we go back to Dealey Plaza and do an experiment, you know, where we run a motorcycle next to a convertible or any car, and somebody filming from Zapruder's pedestal. I'm pretty sure this can be confirmed physically if we go and do some field work, as we have done in the past in Dealey Plaza. I'm pretty sure that this can be, this concept here can be confirmed. And so that's just one of the discoveries that I wanted to bring forth here tonight. The next one, the next slide has to do with the blowout in the back of the head.
Hey, well, Larry.
Yeah.
The main reason is because the officer was in the line of fire, right?
Well, that's another thing that could, we could take up a whole hour of discussion on that. I didn't want to mention it, but now that you did, yes. The reason that Brunson proffered this concept that they had removed Officer Shaney from the Zapruder film would have been because he would have been in the line of fire from a shot from the sixth floor southeast window of the sixth floor of the Texas School Book Depository. And she did a lot of research on that. For example, if you look at the reenactments done by the FBI for the Warren Commission, you will see that as the limos, as the limo comes down Elm Street, they totally removed the motorcycle escort that should have been accompanying the motorcade, the limo. So that's just, another thing that is the reason that why the Officer Shaney was removed from the Zapruder film. Now, this next slide is a drawing by Ida Docks. And Professor Fetzer has discussed this ad nauseum regarding the blowout in the back of the head. And I just wanted to revisit this real quickly here because this was just a drawing done based on supposedly an autopsy photograph. And the next slide here shows the back of the head as the president lay sideways. Okay. And the very next slide is where we have rearranged it in a vertical manner here. And we're just showing it here real quickly here to show what the Warren Commission and later on the HSCA showed, reported here, what the back of the head looked like, supposedly, which obviously this would have been in line with a shot from behind that would have entered the back of the skull, okay, from a shot from behind. Okay, so, and then the next slide is another representation of that, and where they didn't even bother to show the entire head. Okay, now, the next slide shows, and this has been published by Professor Fetzer in Murder in Dealey Plaza on page 174, and it shows the actual witnesses who saw the back of JFK's head and the position of the blowout. Now, these are doctors, and most of the doctors that were in Parkland, and also some of the people that actually witnessed the autopsy at Bethesda. Okay, so it was pretty clear that the blowout in the back of the head and the position of the blowout in the back of the head was. So then later on, the next slide shows what Dr. McClellan drew. And this has also been published by Dr. Fetzer in Assassination Science, I believe. Murder in Dealey Plaza. And the next slide shows a drawing by Dr. Charles Crenshaw. And this is one. This is the one that was published in Assassination Science on page 415. And basically, what we're establishing here is that there was a blowout in the back of the head, and that this was irrefutable. It's irrefutable. There's just no way that so many people could have been mistaken about this wound on President Kennedy. Now, the next slide is frame 374, and this was the blowout in the back of the head as discovered by Professor Fetzer. And he has spoken about this many times, and he has presented this in many of his talks and presentations. And I just wanted to show it here because earlier this year, as we were looking a very good copy of the Zapruder film and images from the Zapruder film, and that's the next slide coming up. We found a frame 343. The next slide, please. Yeah, frame 343. And this frame shows Jackie reacting to what's going on. Okay, and the next frame, what I want to show here is her white glove offers the perfect background, which allows us to appreciate the magnitude of the blowout. Okay, I circled this and I sort of traced it out. And the very next slide shows a, we did an insert here and we traced it in black pencil or ink or whatever, and showing the magnitude of the blowout in the back of the head. We published this on Veterans Today earlier this year. And the very last slide is a sort of like a neon glow representation of that image. And what really drew my attention was, this is Photoshop, okay? But what drew my attention was the presence of the blowout is really, really, really shows in this image here. So, you know, basically, you know, and quickly, you know, I just wanted to go through these images here for this discussion here. And if anybody has anything to add on to this, be more than welcome.
It's great work. Really, I really appreciate it. The one thing I would say is that I have original copies of, well, not original copies, but higher resolution photos of the back of the head. That's one of the people that, one of the photos that I claim is Officer Tippett, because in the version that I have and that I've enhanced, you can go right into the bullet wound and you see hairs growing out of it. And if it were an inshoot, it would have penetrated and obliterated the skin and no hair would be growing out of it. So this is one of the examples from my thesis that the photos of Officer Tippett were used to fake us all out, because Officer Tippett, as we recall, was shot in the temple. The bullet traversed his brain, hit the back of the head, cracked the skull, and fell back in. So there would have been a depression, a beveling of the skull. An avulsion comes out. This is an indentation in plain English. And the indentation has the sagging skin and the hair growing out. At a later time, I'll share that photograph with you. It's quite something. Ida Dox did an amazing drawing. It is so amazingly photorealistic that many people really took it to be a photograph for years, when it wasn't explained that it was a drawing. The other point about the drawings are that we have to remember that Gerald Ford made the Navy corpsman redraw the back wound from between the shoulder blades, moved it up 8 inches and drew it in the trapezius muscle to make the single gunman theory plausible. So we have a lot of work to do, but I'm really glad that all of this is coming out. It was very lonely in 1992 to 97, being the only one who believed that.
Well, don't think the welcome wagon is outside now.
I know. Well, at least we know, gentlemen, you know.
Yeah.
Each of us is doing our work, and I commend Larry on this. This is
Thank
really
you.
Good.
Let's
take hell tell anybody and everybody, don't believe the Zapruder film. If you see it on television, turn it off. It's bad for your brain.
Really. Well, I wanted to back up a little bit when you mentioned the B.J. Martin going around in circles after Zapruder 313. That's when it happened, according to Jean Hill in her book, The Last Dissenting Witness. Mm-hmm. And that was a very important moment, because it really proved how the Zapruder film had been hacked. Because later on, last year when we did the transcripts of the Fred Newcomb tapes of officers Hargis, Douglas Jackson, Bobby Hargis, James Shaney, and B.J. Martin, it became very clear that the motorcade, the limo, stopped for quite a lot of time there. Yeah. We're estimating probably up to 18, 20, maybe up to 30 seconds. Okay, and in order for B.J. Martin to have had time to go around in that type of maneuver, and according to Gene Hill, what he was trying to do was trying to avoid the shot. And his exact words were he didn't want to be like a duck in a gallery. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly what he told Gene Hill at the time. And then we also know that Douglas Jackson went up the embankment there trying to chase down whoever was shooting up there. And then he flipped his motorcycle up there. And we've done research on that as well. And Bobby Hargis himself said that the limo stopped for at least 6 seconds. And then James Shaney said that Bobby Hargis ran in between the limos in front of him as he was stopped. So,
you know, mm-hmm. One of these days we should really dwell a little bit on the Moorman film, because Clint Hill was nearly killed by the Queen Mary. He was hit by that car. And he's lucky that he didn't catch up with the limousine sooner, because he might have lost his legs. But if you look at the Moorman film, at that point where Clint Hill is running, you'll see that he had to brake, Sam Kenny had to brake sharply to avoid rear-ending the JFK limousine. And at that point, the front wheel is turned out 45 degrees. The car has sunk, and you know when the car stops, the front end sinks and the gap between the wheel and the wheel well shrinks. All of that is evident. And I swear, I think that Clint Hill got knocked down.
I think you mean either the Muchmore or the Nix film.
Muchmore.
Right.
Moorman.
Muchmore.
The Moorman. On the Moorman, I had it in the back of my mind because I wanted to talk about that weird Moorman with the thumbprint.
Yes.
Camouflage. You know why? Because she caught the brain matter coming back and hitting his windshield and hitting him. And so by putting this thumbprint over the whole thing, the brain matter.
Very possible. There's a lot of research going on right now on the Moorman by Ralph. Okay. Yeah.
Thank you for correcting me. Muchmore. But also Muchmore. How many times we sliced the nest sliced in triplicates, you know, in three sections.
Yes. Amazing. Yes. So we now know that the motorcade, the limo, stopped for quite an amount of time there, and a lot of this research is really, really being propagated by researchers. For example, Douglas Horn talked about that tape that we did because Stavis Ellis also said in the Newcomb tapes that he was told by James Shaney that a kid picked up a piece of skull that had been blown over onto the infield at his feet. And we're pretty sure that kid was Joey Brehm, Charles Brehm's son, because the angle would have been exactly perfect to land at his feet.
And well, Brehm said he saw it coming right at him.
That's right. And that a Secret Service agent who was in the Queen Mary picked up the piece of skull and just threw it into the limo before the limo took off, before the two vehicles took off. So we know that and
Larry, just to clarify for everybody, so this is a different chunk of bone than, like, say, the Harper fragment.
Right.
Well, that's still being debated right now, because we know that the Harper fragment was not found until the next day at 5:30 p.m. And this fragment that this kid picked up, who I'm postulating could have been Joey Brehm, could have been later on planted down Elm Street to sort of give the impression that this had been blown from JFK's skull from a shot coming from behind him. So that was still, and Dr. Mantic has looked at this and it's still being debated. I'm pretty sure that some of this, you know, is going to be clarified in the near future. But
okay, so where was Brehm's location then?
He right at the right rear left. as rear left as JFK had just passed his position,
just off Hargis's position.
That's right. That's right. That's right. He's seen in the Zapruder film in frames 281, 282, 283.
Well, you know, Doom, I want to bring to your attention an amazing, a wonderful treasure resource is Rush to Judgment, which I viewed again. I saw it in the theaters
The film. Yeah.
But Mark Lane's work interviewing the real witnesses.
That's right.
From this, and this is where Charles Brehm says
that
he saw the piece of skull coming right at him, and the bullet must have gone past him too.
And he was also quoted the next day in the Dallas Times Herald, and then after that, they got to him, and he totally reversed himself 180 degrees, and he said no, that as an ex-Army Ranger, that he knew ballistics and that wasn't the case and that he had been misquoted. And that's the story of Charles Brehm. But his immediate impression and his immediate declarations and interviews that day were that he had seen the shot come from the knoll and that chunk of skull had landed at his feet.
Yeah, clear contrast. All right, Robert. We got a couple of comments from the last video that's been up on YouTube, so I'm going to read one to you and let you comment before we go.
Okay.
All right. All right, says, amazing show, Gary, having someone like Robert Morningstar, similar to the Doug Horn show of 2009. Robert doesn't have a book to sell, so he's a very genuine person. All right, of critical importance that he didn't get to cover in the last show. Robert's claim that Don Groen's show in 2014, that Robert has some film drastically different from the Alter Z film, showing likely, let me get the read more, real events. So can you comment on that?
I think
real question from a real person who watched the video last week.
Your audio is breaking up, but I think it was Robert Groden's film.
What he's claiming is that you spoke in a radio show in 2014 on the Don Grahn show.
Donald Grant, yes. Yes.
That you have some film that is different, like altered, Z film, but not what we're used to seeing.
Yes, I do have a version of the Z film, which I believe was an intermediate version of the doctoring, where the doctoring isn't complete, and I believe that it has certain number of frames that are not to be seen in the Zapruder films that we've been seeing. For example, one of the shots when it opens up his head, a flap of skin goes straight up, and this is more in concert with what Mr. William Newman said to me. Mr. William Newman said that he said it took his ear right off. And I said, no, you know, you made a mistake. It was a fragment going off. You thought it was his ear. But in this film, we see the head split open and a strip of flesh goes straight up like that and snaps back down like a snake coming out.
Yeah, many witnesses said it went straight up. Many witnesses.
And this is the other part, that in certain frames that I've isolated, it's a very rough film. It's not something that was preserved very well. So anyway, the point is that it is more in concert with what Dino Brugioni says and with what Mr. William Newman say they saw. And I'm working on improving the quality. I really had to put it away because it is so horrific, and it shows me that between Z313 and Z340, he was triangulated, and there may have been as many as four shots all at one time. And that's it. What they did is they took out the intervening frames. So let's say there were three shots, and you have your tape across your three fingers, and this is film. You take out the intermediate and the intermediate, you've joined three shots into one. This is what was done with the grassy knoll scene. A fusillade took him out, and the shots would have been flying, pieces of head, his head flying off, and it was just too gruesome. And it's still too gruesome. I had to put it away. It was kind of bad for me to stay on it for so long. But I'm working on it, and when the world is ready, we'll get to see it. But it's enough for me to say, Jackie Kennedy was the only hero in Dealey Plaza.
I thought Jackie actually shot Kennedy.
This is a slander, you know. She was the most courageous person. She embraced him with two arms. And in one of those frames in the embrace, you can see the blood from the back of the head running over the forearm of her.
She was covered in blood when Johnson was getting sworn in on Air Force One there.
Right. Well, anyway, gentlemen, I think all of us would be to be commended for restoring America's true history and breaking up this Wizard of Oz hallucination that the nation had.
It's really a horror show.
It is. That's why I say to people, you know, don't be fooled by the Zapruder film. Pay attention to the splices. Don't look at the president. Look at the background. Watch the splices go by. And once you've learned to see them, don't watch it again. It's bad for your brain.
All right. We'd like to thank Don Fox, Larry Rivera, Robert Morningstar. We'll see you next week. This has been the JFK Show, number 73.
Good night.